For Connecticut Public Radio, I'm John Henry Smith. While humanity has made strides over the past year in slowing the spread of the coronavirus, there's been no such success in slowing down the spread of misinformation and disinformation. To talk about this, Peter Adams joins the program. He's the Senior Vice President of Education with the News Literacy Project. You know, from the exaggerated death of Mark Twain to, remember the, you know, you're probably not old enough, but I know you've heard of the War of the Worlds panic of 1938, claims that the government destroyed the World Trade Center. We could go on and on. Point being, there's rampant misinformation throughout episodes in history. It's nothing new. Is it really any worse today? Are we just more aware of it? Or is it really worse today?
Actually, I kind of think it's both. I think we're more aware of it because it's worse, right? And the reason it's worse is because the means to share completely unvetted and even fabricated claims and the tools to make up, mock up memes and fabricated photos or doctored photos are more accessible than ever before, and then to share those with a global audience. So while there have always been false rumors and claims and hoaxes, I think there have never been, you know, so many spread to so many people before.
Is disinformation still coming from Russia and other bad actors on the global stage, or are the sources more domestic now?
They're more domestic now, especially compared with 2016. Actually, a report from a group called the Election Integrity Partnership, which was a group of researchers that looked at the 2020 election, you know, found just that. Foreign state actors were still active online, exacerbating social divisions, misinforming, disinforming, pushing propaganda, doing all the things they were doing in 2016, but on a much smaller scale, and especially, you know, when compared with what we're doing to ourselves domestically. So most of the misinformation around the 2020 election was being created and pushed and shared by Americans with Americans.
I would imagine that would make it much harder to fight.
Absolutely. I think, you know, I think that's why we have to understand how misinformation works, right? That it's fundamentally exploitative, that it seeks to capitalize on our most sacred beliefs and values, our patriotism, our desire for equality, for fairness, our religious faith, and seeks to use that against us, right? To provoke a strong emotional reaction, kind of override our rational minds and get us to click and like and share and reshare without thinking.
How have financial incentives fueled disinformation?
Well, I think to the extent that social media platforms thrive on engagement and make money from engagement and from keeping people on platform, and mis- and disinformation are hyper-engaging content designed to draw you in, to make you have an emotional reaction, you know, I think they have certainly profited from the circulation of mis- and disinformation on their platforms. And I think that's something that, you know, everybody needs to take a really hard look at together when it comes to regulating that kind of thing.
Well, tomorrow you're named king of the world and you have all power to do whatever you want. So if you have that power, what do you do to rein in misinformation on the major social media platforms?
Well, gosh, I think first, you know, I would devote adequate resources to enforcement of their current community standards, at which most social media platforms absolutely have those resources to dedicate. Most of them are dedicating resources already. I think they could do much more. I would also build, you know, an advisory board. You know, if I were running one of these companies, I would have an advisory board of researchers and other experts who study mis- and disinformation, who study state-sponsored propaganda and conspiracy theories and extremism, and ask them to audit the current platform and standards and the reporting architecture. I think too many platforms forbid a specific type of content or behavior, but then they don't provide users with a clear way to report that behavior. And then finally, I would integrate news and information literacy tips and tutorials and tools into the user interface of the platform. So if you see a iffy photo on Facebook, there should be a way to do a reverse image search right there in platform and recognize that it's manipulated or that it's from 7 years ago.
How long do you think it would take? I mean, if people took your advice right now, if the social media platforms were were reined in the way you just suggested, and if people really started taking a much more active role in scrutinizing the media they're presented with and that they find, how long is it going to take us to get to a point where, you know, that it's not impacting our lives to the degree to which disinformation and misinformation is right now?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think, you know, inevitably, no matter, even with some great successes, even with action by, you know, smart regulation by government, well-intentioned, good faith actions by social media platforms, a push by educators and legislators for news and media literacy, I still think we're talking about, you know, the better part of a generation and a slow movement of, you know, slow progress toward a more news and information literate future.
And as you look in your crystal ball, I mean, that sounds like there could be a lot of damage done. I mean, so many people already have not gotten vaccines because they heard from their aunt, or they read something on Facebook, or, you know, the guy went to a pizza parlor in Washington and held a gun and asked where the children were because of something he read on Facebook. I mean, what's your crystal ball say about what the worst case scenario is of this disinformation deluge that we're swamped with taking a generation to fix?
Well, look, I think it'll be slow progress, and every incremental progress is positive, right? It's very much, in my mind, like the current push to vaccinate the population. So as the rate drops, we have, you know, less and less illness and fewer fatalities, less suffering across the country. And I think that'll be the case here. The real danger and what I worry about is if it goes the other way, right? If we don't do this and it gets worse, then, you know, that's going to spike and can cause, you know, more events like the one that you just highlighted, or for people to make even more decisions against their own interest, or to take violent action, as you cited the Pizzagate example.
Is it just my imagination, or are some of the folks peddling vaccine lies the same folks peddling Trump won the election lies? NewsGuard, a startup that fights false stories, said that of the 145 websites in its election misinformation tracking center, 60% of them have also published misinformation about the pandemic. That includes sites like Breitbart and Newsmax and OAN.
Yeah.
So what overlap are you seeing?
Yeah, I think there's definitely some overlap there, although COVID misinformation really runs all throughout the political spectrum, right, from the far left through to the extreme right. But certainly, you know, election-related misinformation largely centered around disinformation and conspiracy theories about, you know, non-existent election fraud. And, of course, that was pushed on the right. And so in that case, you know, yeah, there was overlap. But I think, you know, among the kinds of outlets you described, I mean, you named three, but that really highlights the need for people to, again, understand what makes journalism credible, understand what, you know, journalistic standards are, what fairness and accuracy and processes of verification look like in practice, so they can recognize when those things aren't being enforced.
Are we the honest and earnest purveyors of information? I don't count those journalism outlets that aren't, but I would say the vast majority of us are really trying to put out good information. To what degree even are we responsible, or do we have blame in the pandemic or the infodemic, I think I've seen you call this infodemic? What role do we play in it?
Yeah, I think institutional media, mainstream media, obviously have to be very careful, and I think have learned some lessons about coverage and how to frame coverage. You know, one thing that comes to mind recently is people who by coincidence pass away shortly after getting the vaccine, even though it's unrelated and it's declared in autopsies to be unrelated. As we vaccinate our seniors, for example, a certain percentage of folks are going to pass away within a certain time frame. It's natural. It's always happened. But if it gets framed as, you know, this person passed away a week after getting the vaccine, it creates a false connection there that is really dangerous, right? That folks might not get a vaccine thinking it's not safe based on the framing of that story. So I think there's a lot of things that news outlets can do to really help the public along and just need to be cautious.
We talked earlier about legislation. Your crystal ball, I want you to take that out again. To what degree do you think that there will be a move to rein in and regulate social media companies? And we'll throw media companies in there as well to stem the tide of disinformation and misinformation.
Oh, yeah. I think it's coming. We've already seen it, with Facebook and Google in Australia responding to legislation there. And other countries, Canada, the UK, are working similar pieces of legislation through their legislative bodies. So I think we will see regulation of social media platforms, around the world, 100%, just to varying degrees in different contexts, in different countries. And I think, we will see a legislative push to support or even require news and information and media literacy for high schoolers, or to be integrated throughout a student's education. It's too vital. And in my view, we really owe it to young people, because this is the basis for their civic agency. If they can't differentiate between something that's true and something that's false, they can't make good decisions for their lives, for their families, for their futures, and for the country. And we owe it to them.
How do folks listening out there who are dealing with a friend or relative who has fallen down a rabbit hole, an information rabbit hole of sorts, how do you help that friend or relative?
I think carefully and patiently, right? And with empathy. It's vital, I think, that people first pause and consider, how friends and family fall victim to false information and conspiracy theories. And remember that, for the most part, they're being targeted and exploited by falsehoods that are designed to appeal to them, that are designed to trigger cognitive biases, that are designed to tap into really strong emotions. So I think, first off, no knee-jerk or angry responses. And then just lay out the facts and continue looking for common ground with that person, things you can agree on. I think it's important to be patient and to really not start a showdown in their comments that other people can see. I think it's important, to raise questions about the accuracy of a post in a comment so other people can see it, and then maybe take the rest of that conversation private or offline even, or even talk to them, on the phone. We actually have a great infographic on our website at newslit.org with, some of these tips and some suggested phrases even to help people start these conversations off on the right foot.
Peter Adams, Senior Vice President of Education with the News Literacy Project, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you, John.